meeting, even if we're doing it remotely. I'll open up and then I'll turn it over to President Reevely. We had a little exercise, which I think is good for reflection for all of us after this year. And what was the silver lining coming out of the pandemic and COVID? And a lot of the board members shared kind of really good personal, heartfelt things that were positives. And it's hard in the last 12 months to think about many of the good things or the things that we're grateful for. With the loneliness and the anxiety and the social issues. And I'll just share, starting out, one of the things that I'm very thankful for and proud of is the hard work of this team and how you pushed through this pandemic and brought a sense of normalcy back to the world that the world desperately needed in higher ed and an enrich environment, richer than a lot of our peers, for our students to learn and feel like at least one part of the world was normal. So I'm very thankful for all the hard work. And I know we all on the Board of Visitors, I speak for the entire board, are very proud of the work that you all have done and recognize the sacrifice and the long hours to be sitting here, seeing a light at the end of the tunnel in Longwood, really being a great example of how to navigate such difficult time. So thank you all. We can't express enough of our appreciation for all the hard work that you've done. Mr. President?
Yeah, no, a deep thanks also to the board on behalf of the alma mater. The fact that we have had such camaraderie and stability and strength on the board has been a hugely important thing for Longwood in the midst of all these challenges. And it's been a wonderful thing and a source of great wisdom, at times great solace, and always real strength. So thank you, all of you all. And it is great to be together. Some fine day we'll be together actually in person again. And in a minute, we will start progressing through a sequence of really important things. In a bit, we'll hear from Justin Folk to give us an overview of how things COVID continue to progress. Once we hear from Justin, we'll then turn things over and pass the conch shell to Lara to give us some perspective on the enslaved ancestors legislation that the General Assembly has acted on this session. It's certainly a great blessing for Longwood that our provost is, among all her other many wonders and attributes, a civil rights historian of great note and acclaim. Then our BOV rep, Dr. Lee Bidwell, will give us an update about faculty matters, and then we will turn things over to Jonathan Page, Cameron O'Brien, to talk us through something that I think we all ought to be very proud of, the Title VI policy that we have proposed. Jonathan, Cameron, others have worked on so hard, a fruit of lots of thinking and result that I think will be very meaningful from the Equity Action Task Force from this summer, and it's a great thing to see that gaining steam so quickly, the Title VI policy. And then we'll try to reserve some time for open-ended discussion and questions and answers with the VPs. And after that, as we customarily do in March, the board will go into executive session with the provost and president to consider matters of promotion and tenure for the faculty. And before we begin making our way through those things, Mr. Rector, do we want to act on the consent agenda?
Yes. Do I have a motion from the board to accept the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Thank you.
I think we can consider ourselves duly approved.
Yep.
Duly approved.
So moved. Yep.
All right. Well, I will pass things to Justin in just a second, but we all know this in one great measure or another, but the work that Longwood has done has really been something to behold with regards to the COVID protocols and the care with which the whole campus has proceeded. It's so many have worked just incredibly hard, faculty, staff, students in particular, really do deserve our plaudits. I don't think we would have expected anything other than what we have seen from Longwood students who are of a wonderful sort, and they have certainly manifested that through the midst of all this. And Justin himself has been right at the heart of the action. It's tempting to think of a university as some sort of Euclidean machine or Platonic Republic that moves simply to the rhythm of sweet reason, when in reality it's a vast and contorted mix of baronies and stakeholders that all have slightly different perspectives and slightly different claims on the truth and slightly different interests and slightly different habits, and keeping us all safe in the midst of all that has been Justin's great focus through the midst of all this pandemic. So I turn things over to the master of the Hydra, Justin Pope, for a COVID update.
Thank you. I appreciate it, and I agree with all of it except the slightly part, so thank you. Just to give everyone a quick update on where we are in terms of COVID, more than halfway through the second semester, I think the word is stable and steady. You know, we continue to have cases on campus. We had an uptick about 2 weeks into the second semester, which was something, interestingly, that every single college that I'm aware of had as students came back from Christmas. I think we just have a routine down, and one thing that Matt McGregor has found that is interesting is, as while we do continue to have cases, he's seeing most of them are coming from elsewhere. They're being acquired elsewhere and being brought onto campus. There's much less spread once they are on campus, much shorter chains of transmission, fewer contact exposures. Not sure what to make of that. I think it means that people, the practices in place on campus work, and people have a sense of what is dangerous behavior and what isn't. They've just gotten more accustomed to it. It's manageable. So we have fewer people in quarantine, fewer people out of class, even though we continue to still have some cases. I think we have 11 at the moment. We should have a number of those coming off the dashboard this weekend, and that's kind of the range we've been in. You know, it's important, of course, to note how students themselves are experiencing this. We're always cognizant they are not numbers. Continues to be the case. We have had no students hospitalized, which is something we were, of course, very concerned about at the beginning of all this. My understanding is that of the cases we've had, all but about 10 is the estimate that have been anything other than asymptomatic or mild. COVID is no fun, as everybody knows. And we've had about 10 to 12 cases that are characterized as moderate or severe for students, but the vast majority, fortunately, have not been. The situation in the state, the situation in our region is actually quite good right now. It's better than it's been in Prince Edward County and the Piedmont Health region. I've spent a lot of time on the phone this year with Centra and other healthcare providers. They had a baseline of about 16 COVID beds at Central Southside Community Hospital. They had plans that were at a couple points activated to move up to 20 COVID beds. They had emergency plans to go to 32 or 40 if they had to. Fortunately, did not hit those. Those numbers have declined, and I understand from a well-placed source that this week they were at zero COVID patients at Southside Hospital. Not sure if that's still exactly the case, but it's remarkable. Centra in Lynchburg, which I think at a time had 120, 125 COVID patients, currently has seven. So the situation in our region is good. The situation in the state is a little unclear. It's plateaued. It's actually up a little bit this week in terms of case numbers. I hope that won't be reflected in hospitalization numbers. We are not out of the woods yet by any means. You know, there is a lot of humility still, I want to assure you. We have seen many, many other institutions with big rapid spikes. In Virginia and beyond, UVA had over 900 active cases at one point. I think there are at least three or four Virginia public universities that have had multiple days with more than 100 new cases, which is really a lot. We have been fortunate. Duke is right now still on a very intense lockdown with several hundred active cases. So we feel very fortunate to feel like things are stable, but we know we still have a ways to go. I think the lessons learned are the same ones that I've mentioned to you before. The dashboard works, having daily real-time information about when cases are going up and down, people adjust their behavior. We hear that from students all the time. When they see cases on the dashboard, they usefully get a little nervous. And I think the main, contact tracing and quarantine support work. And I think ultimately it really is the case that culture matters. Our students have, as President Ravely said, deserve a lot of credit for with very few exceptions, looking out for one another. And I want to single out just one example of I think a proof point of how culture matters. And that's Michelle Meadows and the Department of Athletics, which said particular challenges, not just with the nature of the work they do, but with an incredibly rigorous regime of precautions and testings and worked out through the Big South and the NCAA. They have done an amazing job, and they planned with incredible detail. Rick Cantor has been her point person on that. As part of the NCAA surveillance testing regimen, they have conducted, 3,500 surveillance tests. Now that all the sports are going at once, it's an incredibly busy spring for them. The positivity rate on that surveillance testing is 0.0023. I think it translates to six or seven tests. Just for perspective, in Division I basketball this year, 20% of games were canceled due to COVID issues. Our men's basketball team played all but I think three or four. Only one of those postponements, if I recall correctly, was related to an issue in our program. The women's basketball program, and again, this is a sport that's played indoors in close proximity, zero positive tests all year until quite sadly, just this week, one asymptomatic surveillance test picked up just after they had qualified for their first ever postseason tournament that made it impossible for them to accept that invitation. But incredible that they went the whole season, playing basketball in close proximity. And I think, certainly we saw Duke women's basketball was canceled, men's season ended early, UVA, Kansas, many institutions with much deeper resources than Longwood really, really struggle with this. And it's not just about keeping the student athletes safe. It really has been an effort with the trainers and all the people who are close to them and around the program. There's a Big South program right now that has 40 or 50 student athletes out simply because, at least it's understood to be because of a training staff, the issue of oversight of training staff with them, not the student athletes themselves. So I just want to give a shout out to that program, which has also been a useful and reassuring insight, when we see all that testing data coming in and that with such a low positivity rate, it reflects well in the university too. Briefly, obviously people are very, very focused on vaccinations, as you all know. thanks to Dr. Little and her students and many other people across the university. We were able to be very helpful to VDH in that first stage of the vaccination drive when the vaccines were coming, but the other systems to get shots into arms were not in place. We administered more than 2,200 doses to 1,100 individuals here on campus. That effort, the second doses of that wound up recently. We continue to offer to be helpful to VDH. I know our student nurses are continuing to administer a lot of the doses in our county through their clinical hours at Centra. And our students, in some ways, some of them are starting to receive vaccines. We were able to give vaccinations to many of the student nurses who are in 1A, some student teachers, many student teachers, you know, we've let them know that they should be eligible. And some with chronic conditions, you know, the health center is helping people with chronic conditions who are increasingly eligible between ages 16 and 64 to find their way to vaccination doses in the clinic. And we're hearing that more and more students are having success with that. We hope to be able to administer some, at least in the health center, to a broader student population when that group opens up. And the VDH office, you know, certainly knows that we are, you know, willing to play a helpful role with that. And if it turns out that we're able to do something more broadly for students by the spring, even though that would require another campus-wide effort, if the vaccine supply is there, we will do everything we can to make it happen. So that is where we are. You know, I still lie awake at night a lot and worry about getting to the end of the year, but right now the situation is stable and you know, very clear that it matters to our students that they've been here in person. Happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, and one piece of foresight, not of a medical nature, that's been a very, very helpful thing for us all. It's by taking the temporary salary reductions that everybody on campus did in the spring, we were able, in a way that other universities were not, to make room in our budget this year for the millions of dollars of COVID expenses that we've had. When we restore salaries next year, and if next year does not have the kind of COVID expenses that this year has, as it looks like it will not, we will be in much better stead than places that have been scrambling all year to try to figure out how to make the financial equation work. And further ballast for us is the fact that the state budget, remarkably, because Virginia has weathered the storm so much better than other states, has been strong for Longwood. We're not only making our way through COVID with a great track record of safety thus far, I think, but with great prospects ahead from the soundness of our finances too. Questions for Justin? Questions might pop to mind, and we can loop back. Zoom is always hard to have a really free-flowing conversation. It is something we should all be proud of. How things have been going. We've still got distance to go. But maybe Lara, I will turn things to you to talk about the General Assembly legislation.
Great. Good morning, everyone. It's great to see you. The snow this morning has turned to sun, so I wish you had all been here to be able to experience that. It was horrifying a couple hours ago, but spring is on its way. I am really excited to talk to you about this project and this work. I thought I could start at the beginning just to tell you a little bit about the bill, and then talk a little bit about what our initial approach is going to be. So it's House Bill 1980, and it's called the Enslaved Ancestors College Access Scholarship and Memorial Program. And you may have, there's been some media reports about the bill, so you may know a little bit about it. But essentially, the five public colleges that were founded before 1865, so that includes the College of William & Mary, the University of Virginia, us, VCU, and BMI, shall each implement and execute the program by identifying and memorializing, to the extent possible, all enslaved individuals who labored on former and current institutionally controlled grounds and property. And I'm reading from the bill, by the way. And then providing a tangible benefit, such as a college scholarship or community-based economic development program, for individuals or specific communities with a demonstrated historic connection to slavery that will empower families to be lifted out of the cycle of poverty. The bill also then says that CHEV will collaborate with the five institutions to establish guidelines for the implementation of the program, and those guidelines should be developed no later than July 1st, 2022. So as you know, our work here at Longwood around issues of racial reckoning and memorialization have been ongoing and has initially focused on the history that resonates most strongly with our local community. That is the 20th century civil rights struggle, given the national importance that our community played in the struggle for educational equality. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot, but under Colleen's leadership in 2014, the Board of Visitors issued an apology for Longwood's lack of action during massive resistance, also for its use of eminent domain during that time, and it established the Moton Legacy Scholarship. We also then, in 2018, erected our Freedom Monument across the street in front of Radcliffe Hall. And early last year then, we formed the Bicentennial Initiative as a way to provide an organizing framework and focus to all of our research on Longwood's history. And you might recall John Miller and Kanan Townsend joined us in December to talk about the initial work. But really, the Bicentennial Initiative, while it's an umbrella, it focuses particularly around the roles that African-Americans have played at the university. So identifying and memorializing enslaved workers is another phase of this important work. That research, however, will be challenging and is complicated by the fact that Longwood began as a private institution called the Farmville Female Seminary in 1839. It was organized by a group of stockholders, and the original building that was built in the early 1840s was on the site of where the current rotunda stands. And so there was just one building to the campus here on High Street. The institution was renamed the Farmville Female College in 1860, and then it did not become a public institution until 1884, when the General Assembly passed a bill that created the State Female Normal School, which was the first normal school or teacher training school for white women in Virginia. And this was at a time period, just to kind of place us in the broader historical context. So it's in 1882 that the General Assembly established they chartered the Virginia Normal and Collegiate Institute, which is now Virginia State. That was the first normal school for Black men and women. And it's not until the early 20th century that the state establishes other normal schools for women in Harrisonburg and Fredericksburg and Radford, which are all today now universities. So our institutional records prior to 1884 are scanty at best. And we know of no records right now that shed direct light on the labor practices during the early decades of the institution. That being said, this kind of research is complicated in general. So it's not as if it's uniquely difficult for us necessarily. Now, we do have some important work that provides important context for understanding this period. So I did bring show and tell, since I'm sitting for my bookshelves. But Many of you may know the book Israel on the Appomattox by Melvin Ely. This is my teaching copy. So I used to assign this in the US History Survey. They didn't have to read the whole book. I broke it down for them. But I also have used it in my Virginia history class over the years. And this book focuses on the free Black community here in Prince Edward County prior to the Civil War. And in particular, there was a community called Israel Hill that was formed by people who were freed by Richard Randolph, who owned kind of most of the lands around this part of the Appomattox River. And the individuals in Israel Hill, as well as other free Black people here in Prince Edward County, while they were circumscribed by their position as freed people in a society dominated by slavery, nonetheless, they became successful businessmen and artisans throughout the community. They helped to found the First Baptist Church in the 1830s. They sued people in court over their business transactions, just like white people did. And so we really, Mel Ely has spent, the book came out in 2004, but spent over a decade kind of piecing together these stories. And so he talks about work practices here in Prince Edward County. And what we suspect then, based on his work, is that there was a combination of white, free Black, and enslaved workers who constructed the first building here in the 1840s. I'm speculating based on sort of his portrayal of construction projects at Hampton Sydney, but we can assume sort of it worked in similar ways around the county. It's important to just to note, and if you saw or heard the WVTF Radio IQ story about this that it ran yesterday, is that slave owners hired out their enslaved workers to others. This is a pretty common practice in Virginia in the antebellum period. And so it's quite possible that sort of there were hired out enslaved people who were working on the construction project here. So there's lots of work to do in piecing together and attempting to identify enslaved workers who were connected to the institution in its early years. We may have to work backward from emancipation or later and use those records to try and trace back and identify the names of those who were enslaved prior to the war. So while we have work ahead of us on this front, I just want to mention that as part of the Bicentennial Initiative, we have begun exploring the important roles African Americans have played as workers in other eras of our institution's history. In our archives, we do have payroll records that date back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, and combined with other sources, a picture begins to emerge of the individuals who labored here. The Moat Museum and the Greenwood Library and Archives have also made connections with descendants of individuals who worked at the school after 1884, once it became a state institution. So I just want to give you one quick example. Philistine Ward Mosley, who herself was shut out of the schools here in the 1950s and 1960s, grew up on Main Street, and her father, grandfather, and great-grandfather all worked at the State Teachers College, which was what it was called, starting in the 1920s, and worked at Longwood, as well as other members of her family. Her great-grandfather, Philip Ward, was chief cook and baker from here on campus from 1884 to 1934. And there's documentation in the newspapers and the yearbook of Dr. Jarman giving him a 50-year service award in 1934. Her father, also named Philip Ward, worked as the head baker for 31 years from the time he was 18 until his untimely death at age 49 in 1971. And there's actually really kind of renowned for his fancy and complex cakes that he made for Oktoberfest, these big alligators. I mean, it's sort of really fantastic, designs. And so there's an image of him in the tea room that hangs on the wall. This is in the basement of the dining hall. So we are piecing together these stories and doing this work. And so, you know, again, this early work in the early decades of the institution will be part of this effort. And we look forward to working closely with Chev in developing the guidelines as this program develops. So I'm happy to take any questions. And thank you for indulging me in talking about history. It's a real treat.
Any questions for Lara?
I have one. Lara, how involved are you going to be in this project? I mean, it's your area, but you also have a great deal of responsibilities.
Thank you for asking. I am still in conversation with Taylor about that. Summer does slow down relatively. But we are working on getting some help in the archives in particular, kind of over the summer with a graduate student who can work and kind of spend more time digging in the archives than I have the ability to do. So I've talked with, I'm working closely with John and Kanan. John is trained as a literature professor and also is good at archival research, but we want to make sure that we put some resources to devoting to doing the research. But if Taylor wants to send me into the archives during the summer, I will not object.
It's fair to say it really, really, and honestly would be very meaningful to Lara and very meaningful for all of us for her to get a chance to really work at this herself.
It's quiet there. People can't find me. Thank you, Larry, for asking, though. I appreciate it.
Quick question, Lara. So once you identify these folks, then you have to move to the second piece. And do you anticipate that will look different for each of the five colleges, or will it be kind of a cookie cutter, or will it be a multitude of things that we can choose from? I mean, do you have any sense of that yet?
We don't. I do think that Chev is sensitive to the fact that there's five different institutions and they're in different places and their origin stories are very different. We, you know, the College of William & Mary, founded in 1693, they've been actually working on kind of this historical work since 2009 under what's called the Lemon Project. UVA as well formed a committee to begin this work and has erected a memorial to enslaved workers on grounds. All five of our institutions are part of what's called the University Consortium, University Studying Slavery Consortium. So I think the guidelines will be developed with Chev, and I hope that institutions will be able to, reflecting what the history is, be able to have some flexibility in how they construct a memorial or kind of a sort of memorializing kind of event, as well as kind of how they create what the scholarship program or community program might look like.
If I could, I think it would be appropriate and wonderful if, as we did with the Moton Legacy Scholarship, that the Board of Visitors took a lead on the in support of the scholarship. I'm not sure how that would be formed. That's really a Courtney question and a Taylor question, but I would really like to see our Board of Visitors be in the lead role on that and take a lead position to set the course and the pace for supporting that, as we did under Colleen's leadership, as Lara mentioned, with the adoption of the resolution back in 2014? I thought it was later. But anyway, I really think that's important and shows our commitment to diversity and equity.
I like that idea. Thank you, Pia.
Agreed.
Well, thanks. Thanks, all of you. And thank you, Lara. Lee, would you like to give a faculty update?
I would. Thank you for inviting me. So you all said you all talked a little bit amongst yourselves about lessons learned from the pandemic. And that's kind of what I asked faculty to do here. I know we've all agreed that the pandemic can't end soon enough. And for a year, we've all been dreaming of when life will return to normal. But we all understand that the global pandemic has forever changed the world. And once the COVID-19 crisis subsides, a new normal is going to emerge. Despite the overwhelming losses and obstacles the pandemic has presented, it has inspired innovation and creativity and forced changes that we might want to incorporate into our new vision of the new normal at Longwood. So I asked faculty to share their reflections on what we've done and learned this past year that would help make Longwood a stronger institution in the future. They responded as usual with enthusiasm, and they offered insightful, thoughtful assessment of what has worked and been beneficial and what we might want to avoid working forward. As you might imagine, many of the comments focused on the use of Zoom and other kinds of platforms for teaching online. And while in-person teaching is undeniably important and it is the hallmark of what we do here, Zoom has some pedagogical benefits. The first thing that a lot of faculty pointed to is that students have greater access to course materials. Students are able to access recorded lectures and even participate in class in a live way when they can't be physically present. Now, students who previously would have completely missed course material and been reliant on their classmate for notes, such as the traveling student athletes or those with family emergencies, can join class remotely or watch a recorded class. Students are less likely then to fall behind academically. Additionally, even students who attend class in person are able to go back and review recorded class lectures. Another thing that faculty pointed to is that online teaching options provide a continuity of instruction. The ability to teach virtually provides more continuity of instruction during faculty illness and inclement weather and conference travel. The increased flexibility of being able to teach or take classes from home also encourages both students and faculty to stay home when they aren't feeling well and to avoid traveling to campus when the weather conditions are dangerous. We've seen that online tools can increase student participation in class. Some students are more willing to participate in class using online tools such as Zoom chat, Google Jamboards, and Poll Everywhere. One faculty member said, quote, "I think their texting brain just turns on." Students also have more convenient access to faculty office hours for help outside of class. We have to keep in mind that online teaching and high-flex blends of in-person and online instruction present problems that must be addressed moving forward. Increased workload for faculty is one of the most significant concerns. Online teaching is more time-consuming than in-person teaching in many ways. More information has to be prepared and organized to be posted to Canvas. Zoom recordings have to be edited and posted. High-flex classes, particularly labs, require extra work because faculty have to prepare two lab activities for each week, one for the students online and one for those in person. The teaching workload has interfered with time for scholarly activities, which is an issue that needs to be addressed in tenure and promotion and annual evaluation policies. We've also seen that some students disengage and intellectually check out in an online environment. The online environment, faculty said, facilitates collaboration and connections outside the classroom as well. So for example, this year, the Office of Teacher Preparation set up meetings so that student teachers from across the state could meet with each other regularly. We also saw Longwood pre-service teachers were able to teach virtual lessons to students across the state and provide the cooperating teacher with a recorded lesson for future use. Faculty are able to collaborate with colleagues who live far away on research and presentations. Guest speakers and campus presenters from around the world can bring their expertise to campus without the time and expense of long distance travel. A speaker from Australia recently gave a presentation sponsored by the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies minor. Without Zoom, we probably never would have been able to hear that speaker live on campus. Faculty report that Zoom also makes it easier for them to attend meetings, Blackwell talks, and faculty development workshops through remote access. Another thing that faculty pointed out was some of the technologies that we've added to the classroom have been very helpful. For example, cameras in the classroom allow faculty to provide demonstrations of some techniques up close, such as hand movements while playing a musical instrument that all students in the class can see clearly. Digital whiteboards allow faculty to show how to work problems, and then they can save the document so students can access it later. Investment in live streaming and production services and equipment in Jarman is essential. Production equipment has allowed recorded and live streamed musical performances to be made accessible to a wider audience. Such equipment facilitates online auditions and broadens our recruitment and outreach efforts. Pam McDermott, Associate Professor of Music, offered a vision of how increasing this investment can shape the university. She wrote, quote, "Even when we return to live audiences for concerts and events in Jarman, we should invest in retaining access to more remote audiences through live streaming and web-based interfaces. Jarman could become our state-of-the-art facility for staging and broadcasting events to show the wider world, live and through professional recordings, even as students, families, friends, and members of the Farmville community fill the seats in the house. Imagine," she says, "if any event in Jarman could also be live streamed, and we had the capacity to put that access behind a paywall when tickets are sold for in-person audience. We have an opportunity to be more widely accessible and more widely known." She says, "for a university that is in a remote part of the state, this capability could make us much more visible." So what I'd like the board to understand is that as we plan for the fall semester and beyond, faculty think it's important to consider what we've learned from the pandemic and identify practices, policies, and technologies that will help planning to make Longwood a stronger institution in the future. We as faculty would like to be included in planning a post-pandemic future for Longwood that is not business as usual, but business better than before. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. Questions for Lee? Thank you so much, Lee. Title VI is next for deliberating. And in a second, I will turn things to Jonathan Page and Cameron O'Brien to give an overview and then walk through things. Board members, if the policy appears to be in good order, I would also encourage us to consider adopting it today. I think it would be a strong step for Longwood. But I also want to make sure we've got lots of opportunity to think through it and deliberate. Title VI, and Cameron and Jonathan will do better justice to this, but Title VI, like Title IX, has, I believe, great power to do great good to make sure that all of our students are protected as they pursue their education and protected from racial discrimination, national origin discrimination or harassment, just as they are protected from sexual misconduct or sexual harassment. And I think it's a bold step. As best we know, this would be the first policy of its kind in Virginia and potentially the first of its kind amongst public universities in the country. So that also is real cause to be proud of the work that Jonathan and Cameron and so many have done. Jonathan and Cameron, I'll turn things to you all. Jonathan, perhaps first, to give an overview of this important step.
Absolutely, thank you very much. And thank you for allowing me some time today to speak with you about the process of creating the Title VI policy. So I'll provide a lot of that background information and then turn it over to Cameron to go through some of the finer points and address some of the questions that you may have. When we think about the Title VI policy overall, it really was born from the Equity Task Force work over the summer in sort of response to what was going on nationally. If we look at the climate that was going on, if we look at sort of the notion of the racial reckoning that was going on, we wanted to identify ways that we could be proactive and sort of address some of these concerns. And so the goal of our policy was to create a process for, the ease of reporting complaints of harassment and racial discrimination that could be addressed in a very timely and fair manner. And so once that task was put to us, we really went about the process of doing research. Let's look at what other institutions, particularly other public institutions, are doing across higher ed. And what research kind of showed us is that very few institutions across higher ed, had any Title VI policy, let alone a Title VI office. And so that really put Longwood in, a rather unique position and provided, a unique opportunity for us to be able to draft a policy to establish an office to handle these complaints as a way to really address the needs of the changing DEI climate. And so we relied extensively on, reviewing literature to really help us to identify best practices, and really went about the process of also consulting with DEI colleagues, across the country in higher ed to get their perspectives, their understandings. A lot of my colleagues who worked in offices of inclusive excellence, who work in diversity and inclusion offices, as well, really provided some key insights. And so that really helped us to formulate the process. And I want to just kind of give a brief overview of that today. So when we talk about the process, it was intended to create a very straightforward set of procedures and practices that were modeled from processes of Title IX policy. The challenge here for us, though, was that the Office of Civil Rights clearly established definitions, guidelines, and protocols for Title IX, which haven't been done for Title VI to date. But we believe, and Cameron and I had talked about it, is, with the changing climate, we think the greater emphasis will start to be placed on Title VI going forward, and hopefully OCR may be able to provide, some additional guidelines and resources to help augment, and strengthen our existing policy. So the reporting process will utilize the system that we previously used to collect bias-related incident reports, the Say Something platform, which has been recently converted to the Maxient platform, so that it can be consistent with other types of university reporting that's going on. And the policy also establishes for individuals who've been the subject of harassment and or racial discrimination, as well as those who have knowledge of or actually witnessed the harassment or racial discrimination against another student. And additionally, we had talked about it and included a provision in the policy to address alleged Title VI violations against employees through the Human Resources Department. And so when we think about the intent of the policy, I think that there are a number of key strengths that I want to highlight for you all. The first is education. First, in being able to truly identify, what Title VI is, what its scope is, and use this opportunity to educate campus. And secondly, and I think most importantly, is to proactively identify issues related to diversity, equity, access, and inclusion that may have a direct impact on Title VI. That is training and education on the front end that is ongoing, that is intentional, and that is truly consistent has proven to be a good preventative measure to reduce the number of reported Title VI complaints and incidents. And so I think that is really something that our office and even currently in my office as Director of Multicultural Affairs, we've attempted to really identify some of those key topics and workshops in order to start beginning this training and education now. And the second key strength is really in the supportive measures, services and resources that will be offered to students who have experienced harassment and or racial discrimination, even if it's been determined that there was not a violation of policy. So a lot of it is again, providing a mechanism whereby issues are heard, concerns are heard, and addressed. And even if there's not, a resolution, because of a violation of policy, there is an opportunity to still provide education to campus. And so that's sort of the 10,000 foot view of the policy. And I'll turn it over to Cameron to step us through some of the intricacies of the policy.
Just real quick before Cameron appears, we do have to officially award Jonathan as the winner of the Zoom background award for the day. But Cam, you want to walk us through?
Yeah, it's this was a big task, and Jonathan worked very hard on it. Jen Fraley,
who is the person that I rely on for policy issues, was a great help. And also Sasha Johnson, who's our Title IX coordinator, she really helped us kind of see the bridge between Title VI and Title IX. So I think it is a very good start. And Jonathan's right. When we worked on the Title IX policy, we were faced with, and I'm not overstating it, but 1,000 pages of regulations from the federal government and advice. With Title VI, the federal government tells us that we have an obligation to address racial discrimination and put a stop to it. But how we do it is really up to us. And that's why what Jonathan did here is such a big step, taking that obligation and putting it into practice. And we also drafted it kind of knowing that it would have to be flexible. We can't figure out what the Title VI policy is going to be next year or even next month. And we tried to draft it in a way where we can change the policy and let it grow organically as students start to use the process. Just logistically, it's very much like the Title IX process. There is a complaint which goes to Jonathan, an investigation, notice to the respondent, an opportunity to be heard, an opportunity to appeal. I think the strength of this policy is in the informal resolution, which is something that Title IX didn't have for a long time. People bring complaints or make complaints for all kinds of reasons, and sometimes they want different things from that complaint. Some people just want the university to know that something happened. Some people want the respondent to take responsibility for what happened. Sometimes they want to talk about it. Sometimes they want people punished. But people have lots of different reasons for filing these complaints. And the informal resolution process really gives Jonathan the flexibility to address that in a meaningful way. And I will say, for the Title VI policy, it's great that Jonathan is going to have these dual roles of the Office of Multicultural Affairs and Title VI, because Title VI speaks to what the university has to do. And by joining with the Office for Multicultural Affairs, it also lets us focus on what we should do and what we can do. So I think this is going to be a really strong thing for Longwood. Proud of Longwood, and I'm really proud of the work that Jonathan did on this. And I'm happy to take any questions about it.
Questions from anyone?
I have one. To what degree does the policy allow perhaps Jonathan or encourage Jonathan to be proactive? For instance, the recent incidents nationally, this may not affect us, but involving Asians and Asians American might be a situation if something were to reach out to those particular communities to make sure, it's sort of like a check-in to see if people are feeling threatened or and so forth. It's, I guess, a number of universities they have much higher Asian American populations, have made statements because the threat to the group that's the target of a person who will drive around and kill people at spas is being felt and probably affecting their work and so forth. But I just want to, have you thought about, the groups the group of students who might be, quote, protected by the larger umbrella of what we're trying to do here?
Absolutely, I can speak to that. Certainly, even within the capacity of multicultural affairs, we've established a number of affinity groups, of which students who identify as part of the Asian American population have been a part. There's also a club and organization called ASIA, the Asian Student Involvement Association. And so ever since the summer, when these incidents that we saw of racial reckoning broke out in force, we've had our finger on the pulse of staying in contact with the communities, creating those open dialogues and areas to be able to communicate. So we've been able to really track a lot of the increase that we're seeing in attacks against the Asian community, particularly against those who older populations within the Asian community, and really be able to start to address some of their concerns, some of what they're feeling, family members who are affected. So I think through multicultural affairs, we're being very proactive in sort of addressing that, but also allowing students to know that there is a process by which they can file a report, that they can come in and talk and be heard, that they can have incidents documented. So I think we have some of that in place already, and I think that gets strengthened by some of the work that we can do here with the Title VI policy.
So, Mr. Rector, I'd like to make a motion for us to approve the Title VI policy.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion accepted. Thank you, Michael.
Oh, I have another question.
Sorry, who seconded that?
David did.
David. Paul Bunnell, yeah.
Just another quick question. First of all, Jonathan and Cam, thank you so much. I think this is awesome and amazing. One of my questions is now that it's been approved, how do you go about educating the students about this? And that's my big question.
Thank you for that. That's a great question. One of the things that we're going to set to the task of doing, and this is with the continued creation of the office, is really starting to create some literature, some materials, working with marketing and communications to be able to put a Title VI office on the website, to be able to provide resources, information that students can utilize. So that's sort of the next step is creating those sort of outward facing platforms, creating materials on social media that students can avail themselves of, and certainly creating a lot of those, because students have still said that even though we're living in a digital world, they still like that tangible hands-on type of material. So creating brochures, creating postcards and things that will be distributed across campus, certainly doing a very active campaign come this fall. With our first year students with New Lancer Days, making sure that incoming students are aware of that, and really using that platform of the summer and using Lancer Link to share with a lot of our clubs and organizations what's going on. And I'm really looking forward to working with Lara and Academic Affairs to kind of spread this information to our faculty colleagues so that they can also disseminate information and even perhaps put it as part of information that goes on the syllabi.
Thank you.
Jonathan, are there any immersion programs we facilitate with freshman students that may be coming in from very culturally diverse, environments and geographies where we foster these conversations and experiences?
There are. There, again, through an organization that Multicultural Affairs has kind of put together, it's an organization with the acronym CHANGE. They are representatives of the multicultural organizations that are here on campus. So we do a lot in terms of outreach and trying to connect with students from underrepresented student populations to provide partnerships, to provide sort of those networking opportunities. There's also a program that we have out of our office called RISE, which is a mentoring program. It's a transition program for underrepresented students who are transitioning from high school to college. And it really focuses on the co-curricular experience to help them navigate Longwood University, as well as to provide, you know, those communities that, that foster that sense of belonging and connection. And so, you know, and one of the things that, that we're also starting to institute going into next year is we want to be able to document, you know, people's lived experiences and be able to collect some of those narratives, because that really helps inform a lot of the decisions that we make going forward about programming activities, you know, and trainings, you know, that need to occur. But also additionally, the University Diversity Council, you know, is again putting the, you know, the final touches on the 5-year diversity strategic plan. And one of the, you know, goals that the one of our subcommittees has put forward is creating some trainings for incoming students. And so actually next week we have a meeting with two vendors, one Vector Solutions and the other EverFi, who have products that allow us to present this information to students in something like a Canvas platform. You know, modules are created whereby they can go in, you know, view some videos, read some training materials, take assessments, and it's able to really track, you know, growth and development. So we're really excited about the prospect of that. I think that's also going to enhance, you know, what we do.
That's great. Thank you. Any other questions for Jonathan? Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you.
It's a proud step. It was a proud step. Well, we nicely do have a good 20 minutes, 25 minutes or so of more unstructured, open-ended time to ask questions of the VPs or touch on other thoughts anybody might have. Don't be shy.
Louise, you out there somewhere?
I'm trying to.
Oh, there you are.
Yes.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the financial summary and also kind of the COVID expense portion of it, as and then maybe the the cherry on the top might be the federal assistance that may be helping to fill that.
Yes, I'm happy to. Thank you for asking about that. This year has been challenging, and like President Rivlin mentioned, if it hadn't been for the payroll reductions that everyone so graciously took, it would have been even harder. Our COVID expenses are tracking to be a little bit more than what we had thought they would be. There are a number of reasons why, but it's not insurmountable. You all saw the dashboard. I am very happy with this dashboard. I think this year could have gone much worse, but things are coming together really nicely. Right now, all of the VPs are working very, very hard to manage their expenses. And we're also working with them to better understand where their individual budgets may come in for the year. But the CARES money that we have received is going to be very, very important to us. This dashboard does not reflect recent money that we received, about $5 million. A good portion of that does have to go to our students directly, and we are working on the best way to facilitate that. But over $3 million of this can go to offset revenue losses that we experienced due to COVID. So I'm feeling very good about our financial situation right now. Again, I'm always reading the Chronicle, and I'm so worried about so many other universities and colleges out there, and so thankful that we are not anywhere close to situations like that. I'm happy to answer questions about the dashboard. Some of the anomalies that I think are maybe helpful to explain, for example, in scholarships, our year-to-date number of 4.8 million looks relatively high compared to what we budgeted. This is a snapshot in time. Those scholarship dollars will be moving around. We do a lot behind the scenes with scholarship dollars to maximize them. So we are definitely going to be on forecast for that expense. But overall, I'm very, very happy with where we stand, and I'm happy to answer any questions about the dashboard.
Any other questions on the dashboard? Thank you, Louise.
Thank you. Oh, one other thing. I would like to also add that Jonathan came into my direct reports and did a fabulous training on multicultural awareness. And it was so eye-opening and wonderful. And he's just doing such a great job in that. And he is, you know, he is just a superhero, what he's able to accomplish for campus. So just wanted to give him kudos for working so hard and being such a great help to me. So thank you, Jonathan.
Don't make me call on people.
This is Nadine, and I have a question for Courtney, because I'm really curious about how all the COVID dynamics and the separation and reduction of the possibility to meet folks in person has impacted development efforts, and how you guys have been able to manage that with all the other chaos and confusion that's out there.
Hello. Good afternoon, 9 minutes into the afternoon. Thank you, Nadine, for your question. It has been a learning experience. You know, we did stop traveling and visiting with people, and we stopped and did not have any donor events where we would normally have people come into campus. But what we had is we scheduled virtual donor events so that we could keep them engaged and our supporters would know what we were doing on campus. And we also had virtual donor visits, which was something that seemed really like the Jetsons, if anybody knows them, in the beginning. But I think it turned out to be some, you know, I think a year ago, nobody wanted to even have doctor's appointments virtually, but now we do. And so I think now the virtual donor visit is actually something that is probably going to stick around, Nadine, if I had to guess, because it, especially for, and I know you're familiar with fundraising, that first donor visit, that initial one, you know, you might be feeling like, yeah, I'm kind of interested what's going on in my alma mater, but I don't necessarily want to take off work and go to the coffee shop and meet somebody. So I think that first donor visit virtually had been one of those happy things that came out of COVID. Well, you know what? Maybe this is the way to meet people. And on the Longwood resources side, you can do a lot more of those in a day than you can traveling to do it. So I think that that's been interesting. Some other interesting factoids have been that in the beginning, we were doing our events and a lot of our virtual communications at probably 7 o'clock at night. So we thought, okay, people have gotten home, they've sat down, they've eaten dinner. Well, now, then that worked well in the beginning. Now what we hear from people is, you know what, if it's before five is when we want to do it, because we are zoomed out by the time 5 o'clock comes around. So we have done our donor events during the day, and we've also had telephone callers calling during the day, because that is when we've had more luck reaching people. It does matter which audience you're calling a little bit, but the donor events was just interesting to me that at 7 o'clock, people are like, I'm done virtual. So it has been interesting. Fundraising did continue, and I'd say we had success within a global pandemic. But I think that we also just had to be really cognizant of where people were and make sure that we were talking to them about things that they were interested in. And everyone was affected in a different way, but I am really proud of the team and all that they learned of how to adapt during a fundraising during a pandemic. I was at Longwood post 2008, and so I thought, oh, well, maybe I have some experience there that'll help me shape and lead the team. This was all different. It was all different. Everyone was affected differently, but it was great. We had a lot of time to also work together as a team on professional development. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it really does. And kudos to your team for being able to just navigate that. And it's a testament to the great sales pitch and the great product that you're selling. So thank you.
We also completed the Family of Scholarships campaign during the pandemic period. So we had launched it in October of 2019. And I thought, this is not going to bode well. We had 90 matching opportunities for student scholarships. So we were seeking 90$15,000 gifts. And when the pandemic happened, I thought, spring was when we were going to have these donor events and these mailings, and we took it all offline. Well, it did complete through it. So I think that just stands as a testament to the dedication and the support in the Longwood community and the alumni body that said, you know what, scholarships are still important regardless of what's going on.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. P, can I ask how counseling services are going? Have you been seeing a rise in those? Are we able to accommodate what is being sought from our students? Any update in that area? You're muted, Dr. P.
I was thinking the boss had to unmute me. what they have done, and it's worked very well, as they get folks in, they triage them to look and have them join a group first. And so particularly for the issues of anxiety and depression that just, you know, we know those have skyrocketed across the country. And so they'll get involved in a group. And those have worked very effectively in managing those. The other thing that has been effective, we have about three or four Zoom rooms over there also. And it's surprising how effective that form of contact with our student clients has worked for them. So they have felt really good about that. And I think coordinating this very well, we did some changes in our care team, and Jen Fraley, as she was appointed Dean of Students this last year, did some refocusing of that. And I think that's helped us a lot in terms of zeroing in on the most critical issues that we have to be looking at. I think the other thing during this COVID period, you know, one of the things that we got a lot of feedback in the fall was we did the National's Survey on Student Engagement, a PULSE study. So we surveyed our students and got a lot of feedback from them in terms of the kinds of issues that they were dealing with, and actually did a little workshop with that yesterday with our entire staff. So I think it's not only CAPS that has been reaching out, but I know the RCL staff has been doing a great job with the RAs, making contact with students. So it's really a very pronged approach to those issues.
Thank you. Have you noticed an increase, just out of curiosity? And if you don't off the top of your head, I understand. I'm sorry, I don't mean to catch you off guard.
Percentage-wise, yes. I don't, the numbers, you know, because our enrollment is shaved a little bit down this semester, our numbers are down, but the percentage is up. And that almost goes across the board with almost every activity that we have. I mean, if I look at the involvement in Greek life, we have last year at this time, we had 680 students involved in Greek life. We have 667 right now. We have currently 45 students running for student office, which is really, last year we had 37. So I'm really encouraged by student involvement during this period of COVID and how they are reaching out to one another because of that. What they characterized in the NESE feedback we got was just a loss of community. And so they're really reaching out for that. I think our students in particular, that's part of the reason they're here, that sense of community.
Can I ask one last question of Dr. P? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
One more. Given the recent death on VCU's campus, fraternity hazing death, are there any Are we doing any further education around this? Can you update us on how that might trickle down to what's happening at Longwood?
One of the groups that we have in all most Greek campuses have this is the Order of Omega, which is a group of students that work with our fraternity and sorority life. And for all new members and current members, they go through programs every year on this. A lot of it is certainly risk management. They'll get into that an awful lot, but also the hazing. In fact, we've had a couple cases this year. They're not horrific kinds of things, but we have a sorority right now that is on probation. In fact, I'm doing an appeal with them next week. They had some other things that were going on. And so the nationals are very in touch with us on this, and so is the campus. So this continues to be something we watch very closely. The thing with Longwood is, I would also say this, with our concurrent jurisdiction with the town of Farmville and our relationship with the landlords in town that Jen Cox assists us with, we have a pretty good eye on things that are going on. And I think Jen Fraley could report on just how much see something, say something in our Maxient program that Jen really steered putting that together has helped us not only with COVID violations, but any kind of violation. So we keep a pretty tight bead on things.
And to dovetail quickly with something that Lee was saying a little bit ago, and then with what Tim was just saying, and Courtney, Zoom, while we're all going to be delighted to be Zooming less, probably really will have lasting new normal time uses, whether it's mental health or donor visits or classroom pedagogical uses or the different type of thing. Cam Patterson and Moten have been making really good use of Zoom with regards to outreach statewide and nationally. And so there are silver linings to our Zoom mediated lives that'll probably carry forward.
Professor Reeves, I would echo that. Typically I'm in a meeting with all the other vice presidents across the Commonwealth, and we Zoom weekly together to talk about, you know, the progress on COVID and things like that. And it has put us much more in touch with one another during this time. The other thing I would even say, and I think, Louise, you might even say this about your staff, our staff meetings, mine can be 55, 60 folks in those staff meetings. And we're able to, when someone is speaking, you can kind of zero more in on their facial expressions and connect with them in kind of a different way. SGA has been very successful this last year, Zooming. I mean, they can't wait to get back in person, but it has worked very well in a lot of ways for us.
This is what Tim's staff like. on this yesterday.
they do have
a whole bunch of them.
Hamburglar.
Okay. Let me go back to normal and get out of your way.
You know, if I could make one more comment regarding Jonathan, and I think Jonathan has done yeoman's work, not only on the policy, but like Louise said, the amount of contact that Jonathan has across the campus. I mean, they did in excess of 20 programs this semester and training sessions, not only for faculty and staff, but student athletes, different groups across campus, and the contact that we have with our underrepresented populations through the Multicultural Affairs Office. I think the president meets with them a couple of times a semester, the leadership of them, those groups, and it keeps us much more in touch with them. And I think, Taylor, I think your access to them has been better since we've put that together. And Jonathan really and Quincy Goodine, our assistant director there, really deserve a lot of credit for that.
Very much.
Well, Zoom's not going away. We're continuing the licenses for next year. So just just to allay any fears. Victoria, and also, I am not a cat. So.
Victoria, can you mention or talk a little bit about your crystal ball on enrollment and what it might look like in the fall for a few minutes?
Hello, everybody. It's so good to see you. So in terms of this admission cycle, it's definitely been a challenge. You know, we started off needing to adjust all of our in-person visits to be able to do virtual. But I will also say that we have kept on-campus visits going throughout this whole time. And we have over 100 juniors coming to visit during their spring breaks on campus coming up. So we're taking the situation that we have and trying to make it work. And the team has really, you know, for if we normally have an on-campus visit, we're keeping the groups down very small. So we would have maybe one or two events a day, and now we'll have 10 or 12 events a day. And we'll make sure that they don't cross in the parking lots. And so that being said, there are definitely gonna be some challenges. First and foremost though, in terms of our applications, we'd started off this cycle saying, you know what, again, with crystal ball like precision, we think that we'll be down year over year 20% in terms of our applications. Now, again, you might be able to remember as last cycle was on every metric was our best cycle the institution has ever seen. So it was a real banner year. And right now we are trending just about 8% down in terms of applications. But on the other hand, our numbers are still very high because they are in reference to a really good cycle. So just to use as an example, right now we have just over 5,500 completed applications for the freshman class. Last year at this time, we had 5,900, but then the year before that, we only had 3,900. And the year before that, we had 4,600. So we had never at this time even broken 5,000 in our completed apps, except for last year. So we're having the second best cycle in terms of just sheer metrics. But the uncertainty of all of that is very challenging. Two of the things besides the visit factor, which is always very strong for us, is the fact that SATs were optional for most schools, including ours this year, and will continue to be for most schools, at least for the next 2 years. Mostly that has been just around the test. You couldn't even take the test. And so that has provided booms of application generation for not only the most elite schools, but your large public regionals and your large public schools and state schools. So the wait lists for all of these schools are very deep. So students that would normally be communicating with us or depositing with us right now are telling us, you know what, we're still a maybe. Because we're waiting to see if things are going to shift around. So that's going to be very challenging. The other thing too is that the financial impacts to students and families is being reflected in the number of students and families that are filing the FAFSA forms. They're trending behind year over year. And for areas, so for example, schools, high schools that have a concentration of students of color are down 15% year over year in terms of filing FAFSAs, not just with us, this is a national trend, as opposed to schools that have low minority populations are only down 5%. Same thing with Title I eligibility for high schools. We're seeing the same thing. 12% down year over year of students that are in Title I eligible schools versus 7% down of schools. So there is a lot of just so many variables this year that are going to be different. But I will say we still are using our predictive analytics to be able to focus in on students who are more of a maybe than are just no, or have some challenges around, you know, is it a financial issue or is it an issue that they, within their area of study, we did some more outreach specifically on students who are coming in undeclared to help them figure out and explore areas of interest. Faculty have been great on doing both in-person and Zoom meetings and outreach with students who are not quite sure what they want to study, but it helping them explore their areas of interest. So, you know, the numbers actually look really good, especially, you know, if we took COVID aside, if you just looked at our normal just statistics on application generation, where they're coming from, strong programs and desire for those programs, of course, including the nursing program, the numbers look really good. It's our second best cycle. However, there is that, you know, kind of the iceberg under the water of lots of variables for students and families that are going to make how we fall out this cycle a bit more challenging and have a bit of a longer time frame than typical. I know I always say, you know, I'm always like, I'm cautiously optimistic, and I am cautiously optimistic. Based on just the number and the effort that we have put in to differentiate ourselves. And to, you know, just as a quick example, and I know we're running out of time, but so we usually have our summer decision days that are very popular where students come in over the summer and they can get their acceptance, they get their information evaluated, and then they can receive their decision right there. Well, last year when we were like, oh, we don't have the summer, you know, we're not going to be able to have students on campus, we quickly rebranded it to accelerated decision. And we have done them all through the summer and the fall. And we had almost the same number of applicants in the program that we had last year. But we quickly rebranded it and were able to do it differently. But we ended up with almost the same result. So that's just an example of, I really know in our heart, we did the best we could by taking out and the team has allowed me to push and push and push and push and to be creative and accommodating and to pivot when we could.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Two different quick thoughts as we get to 12:30. So one, ought to take a minute just to give a cheer for both of our basketball teams, both as we all know, in the semifinals at the same time in the Big South tournament for the first time ever, and that's a really great thing to have them both doing so well and poised for the future. Great testament to what Michelle has done and what Coach Dillett, Coach Aldridge have done. And Michelle has also been just incredibly busy because there has been a moment when all of our teams have been playing at the same time, which usually is split over three seasons rather than compressed into one mega season. So that was one thing I wanted to just make sure we all focused on and celebrated. And the other, I don't think we have been gathered since the truly remarkable and wonderful and moving. At one point would have been unbelievable news about Barbara Johns and Statuary Hall in Washington came to pass. And since the General Assembly has moved through its ceremonial steps in making that a reality, Cam Patterson was a great hero himself in helping to shepherd that along. But that is a wonderful thing that the record ought to reflect, that when we gathered, when we had that news, that we really celebrated it. That is a great thing. Well, Mr. Rector, we have gotten to 12:30, you might have a closing thought or two, but at that point we can begin to take our steps into executive session to contemplate promotion and tenure as well. But for my part, I will say thank you to everyone. It is great to see everybody.
President Reevely, I know that Kim Little has been on the call, and so I wonder if we could just share the news of what was approved in the consent agenda by the board.
Yeah, Kim, the board approved a very beautiful resolution in honor of our nursing program and your heroics, and we will get this resolution framed in a very big and elegant frame, and we will get it hung somewhere prominent in Stevens, if that would be your desire, perhaps. And I think it would also, this was an idea that Colleen had, also be a wonderful gesture to print up copies for each of the faculty members, each of the students to have as a keepsake for this great moment in Longwood's history. Thank you, Kim. It's a remarkable thing that you led the vaccination clinics here on campus.
You're most welcome. Thank you all for your support, and to Justin for really just leading this project. So thank you so much. It was our honor to take part.
Mr. Rector, any concluding thoughts?
I'm really glad you mentioned the basketball teams and the sporting successes we've had this year, and also the work that Cam has been doing at Moton. I think those are two things that we almost ran out of time to talk about, and also the work that Kim's team did makes the Board of Visitors very proud that Longwood and the nursing school was on the front end, helping out at a time that part of the, it seems like we're running into logistics problems throughout the whole course of the vaccination process, and that Longwood and the nursing team was able to step up just as the faculty was this year, and the administration and the rest of the team has stepped up in a way that really has been heroic and something that you all should be proud of. The Board of Visitors certainly is proud of it. And we look from the snowy morning that started and the sunny day outside here today, and it gives, I think, everyone a little hope for reopening and what next year might look like. Uniquely different than this year, but I really like the way Lee mentioned there were positives that came from it, and not only uniquely different, but uniquely better. And we're looking forward to that. So thank you all.
Truly, thanks everybody.
Graduation. Possibly.
Possibly. Maybe. And what format?
Yeah.
Truly, truly thanks everybody. And Board, please stay in place in your Zoomy positions, and everyone else, you can begin to drop off as the board will prepare to move into executive session. Thanks, everybody.
Mr. Secretary, can you please